Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our first look at the Keddie murders. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast or Deathcast Pod. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early and ad-free shows, as well as to exclusive series. And if you act now until the end of December, I'm offering a month free at the Deathcaster tier, which is the middle tier, and I'm offering 2 months free at the supporter tier. That's tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. Just like my friends Channel and Anthony, Debbie, Betty, Matt, John, and Kenny. Again, that's tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, or just click the link in the show notes. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! Now, as I said in the preamble of the show, I originally covered this case during the first year of the show. The Keddie murders are one of those crimes that has fascinated me completely ever since I first learned about it, and that fascination has only grown stronger with the passage of time as new information has come out, suspects have been named, and the authorities have pushed on about with starts and stops in trying to solve these crimes. And before we get into the meat of the matter, we really need to look at Keddie, California. Where is it? Now, most people, when they think of California, they think of San Francisco, San Jose, Los Angeles, San Diego, those highly populated areas. However, if you go north of San Francisco, you start getting into those areas like Ukiah and Redding, Susanville, that are sparsely populated compared to the rest of the state. Now, in terms of trying to envision this area, the best way I can describe it is, if you recall the opening scenes to Stanley Kubrick's movie The Shining, when they're driving in the bug through the forests and the mountains, that is Northern California. I lived up in Northern California in Tama County for almost 10 years, and I can tell you it's very rural, very small town. There's a lot of ranching going on up there, as well as agriculture. You can go up there and very quickly get lost and disappear. Now, Keddie, California is actually in Plumas County. To give you an idea of how small an area that we're talking about, in the 2020 census, there were 51 people listed as living in Keddie. Now, Plumas County, as of the 2020 census, only had 19,790 people living in it, with the county seat being Quincy, and the only city being Portola. The county is in the northeastern part of California, in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. As for Keddie itself, a post office was established in 1910 and closed in 1966. Keddie has never been a largely populated area, as most of Plumas County has not been. And it's mostly a vacation spot with the main area of interest being the Keddie campgrounds, which is where these murders end up taking place in 1981. There has been, for decades, a steady flow of drugs through this region, as well as allegations of corruption for local governments, as well as for various different police departments. Something that is going to play a part in these crimes. Three of the four victims are going to belong to the Sharp family, with the fourth victim being a friend of the family by the name of Dana Wingate. Glenna Susan Sharp, born Glenna Susan Davis on March 29th, 1945 in Springfield, Massachusetts, and known to everyone as Sue, ended up marrying a man by the name of James Sharp at some point in the 1960s. James is reported to have been in the Navy. The two had five children. John, born November 16th, 1965. Sheila, who was a year younger than John. Tina, born July 22nd, 1968. Rick and Greg, both of whom were born in the 70s. There's conflicting reports on what exactly happened between Sue and her husband John. Some sources state that John was abusive to his stay-at-home wife. Others that he had sexually abused his daughters, and that he had impregnated a Filipino woman whom he had brought to the United States and set up in a nearby home with the intention of keeping both his household with Sue and the household with this other woman. Although I could find no evidence beyond speculation on various websites dedicated to this case to support any one of these theories. However, numerous people who knew the Sharps stated rather emphatically that they were told that John Sharp had specifically sexually abused Tina, the youngest daughter, which was the impetus for Sue Sharp to leave John in 1978. Most authorities agree that the family at that point had been living in Connecticut. However, some sources state that they had actually been living in North Carolina when the split occurred. Now, we do know that Sue's older brother was living in Quincy, California at this point, and that she headed west in order to have a family member nearby. We know that Sue and the children eventually ended up settling in the Claremont Trailer Park in Quincy, and that her estranged husband visited them there at some point during 1979. Now, because Sue had very little money coming in from what the Navy gave her, as they were still legally married, Sue ends up getting on food stamps and also enrolling in something like a vocational training program that gives her a small monthly stipend and allows her to take a typing course at Feather River College. And it's in this typing course that Sue ends up meeting some people, the Meeks as well as the Smart family consisting of Marilyn, her husband John, and Marilyn's children, who are all going to end up playing a role in things later on in this story. Sue is also known to have worked at the Quincy Elks Lodge part-time as a dishwasher. At some point during 1979, Sue learns that cabin number 28 up in the Keddie Resort is going to become available when the current Plumas County Sheriff, Douglas Thomas, moves out and returns to living in Quincy. Keddie is an old railroad town. A lot of these cabins were initially built for railroad workers. This cabin had been a one-room shack, had been renovated numerous times throughout the years, was built into the side of a hill. There's a downstairs unfinished basement that's going to serve as a bedroom for John. Although this basement has no access to the upstairs of the house unless you exit the basement and go up a flight of steps or walk up and around the side of the house and go through the front door. And for this reason, we know that Sue was in the habit, once they move in, of leaving the front door to the house unlocked. Now, upstairs, there's two bedrooms. One that's behind the living room where the younger boys are going to stay. And then another bedroom with two beds where Sue and her two daughters are going to sleep. Despite the financial struggles, the Sharp family had integrated themselves into the Quincy / Keddie community. And by the time they end up moving into these cabins, they already know a number of people who are living up there. In addition to these cabins, there was also a lodge, as well as a bar that was beneath the lodge, and a hotel. And all of this was located off of Keddie Resort Road, and this includes most of the cabins. Now, from what I was able to learn, pretty much everybody that lived up in the Keddie area in this resort knew one another. Most of them came from lower income brackets. Some reports have it that there was quite a bit of violence up in this resort during this point in time, as well as a good amount of drug dealing. Which, from an outsider's perspective, is rather surprising given that the sheriff had just lived there. There's speculation about how Sue found out about the cabin, whether it was from the Meeks family or her brother, or possibly through the Sharp family, who had moved into the area not long before Sue did. They lived in Cabin 26. We do need to look at some stories that have come out concerning the Sharp family's time living in Quincy, and which would continue on into their period in Keddie. The general narrative since these crimes were committed has been one of a single, hard-working mother struggling to get by while raising five children, going to school, working a part-time job, etc. However, from police files and statements given by those who knew the family during this period of time, a different image emerges. One wherein Sue Sharp is almost never around, often either out at school, of which it should said she only attended 2 months, or running around with various men, one of whom was a man by the name of Randy, who stated to investigators rather emphatically that Sue was not a good mother, and that this in fact was the reason that the two of them had broken up, as he could never get a hold of her when he contacted the house, as the children would be there and Sue would not be. Other stories came out as well, including from the Meeks family, who is said to have been the family that the Sharps were closest with, that the children more often than not were left unattended, roaming the streets, often underdressed and looking for food, that Sheila was usually left in charge, and that specifically during the time that the Sharps lived in Quincy, she would lock the other children out of the trailer while she and Tina stayed inside watching television. And I'm not casting aspersions on Sue Sharp or any of her children for the things that occurred within their lives, but if we're going to talk about this case, we need to discuss every single aspect of it. And it's almost certain that Sue Sharp, away from her husband, who she'd been married to since at least the mid-1960s, now she's 33, 34 years old. It's very possible she's going through something of an identity crisis. Even the Meeks said that Sue was rarely, if ever, home, and that when she was home, she was rather standoffish and spent the majority of her time at the house indoors watching television while her children were left to fend for themselves. This is not uncommon for single-parent families, especially during this period that we're talking about. In any event, some point late fall, early winter 1980, the family moves into this cabin up in Keddie, while the children continue to go to school in Quincy. So you have cabin 28, which is occupied by the Sharps, cabin 27, which is occupied by the Seabolt family, the children of whom are friends of the Sharp children. And in cabin 26, you have the Smart family, consisting of Martin, Marilyn, and Marilyn's children. Now, there's a whole lot of disjointedness to everything involving all of these families. So we're going to focus on one family at a time. At this point, we're going to move to looking at the Smart family. It's difficult to pinpoint when exactly Marty and Marilyn met, although we're going to do our best to go over a chronological timeline, specifically focusing on Marty. Martin Ray Smart was born May 11, 1949 in Tracy City, Grundy County, Tennessee. James Elsie and Beulah May Smart. He has two brothers, Spencer Keene and Janice Irene. We know that in some point during 1957, the family moves to Phoenix, Arizona. That shortly before graduating high school, Marty ends up running away from home and winds up in California, where he meets a woman named Linda, who's a year older than him. The two end up getting married, with Marty lying, stating that he's 19 years of age. This is in Imperial County, California. We know that Marty, again lying about his age, joins the U.S. Army, where he's a cook serving in a non-combat unit in Vietnam. It doesn't appear that his service record was anything to write home about. However, according to his ex-wife Marilyn, Marty ends up doing time in the brig while he is in Vietnam, although she never elaborated as to why, saying it had something to do with drugs and the commander's daughter. Upon returning to the States, Marty and his wife settle in San Bernardino County. They have one child somewhere around this point. Eventually, Marty decides that they're going to go down to Phoenix, where his family lives. There are stories out there that while they were down in Phoenix, Marty attempted to kill his brother and also threatened to blow up his parents' house. There are unconfirmed reports that it's around this time that he meets Marilyn. The wife has another kid, and then Marty decides that they're all going to go up to a friend's house in the Northwest. His wife, who is pregnant, ends up having the child in Corvallis, California. This was some point in 1972, after which Marty's trail kind of goes cold. He bounces back and forth between California and Arizona, sometimes going up to Oregon. It's about 2 hours north of where I lived in Northern California, and there's really nothing there. This is back in the 2010s, so I have to imagine during the 1970s, 1980s, Bernie was much more remote and rural than it currently is. Now, according to this timeline of events, Marilyn was living with her son and an aunt in Bernie before Marty ends up joining them there. Now, this aunt stated to Plumas County Sheriff's officers at a later point, one of her daughters with her, appears that she left her other two children with family down in Phoenix living with her. May 14th of 1979, Marty and Marilyn get married, and at some point in this, Aunt co-signs on a red station wagon for the Smart family. Some point in the summer of 1980, Marty learns of the job up in Keddy, working as a cook, which includes housing. He travels there, interviews for it, and gets the job, at which point he returns to Bernie, gets Marilyn, and they travel to Keddy, after which they are joined by Marilyn's two other children. There are stories out there concerning Martin Smart that he had been selling drugs since getting out of the army, and that when he moved to Keddy, this continued, with most stories claiming that he was known to sell marijuana and hash, and on occasion, heavier things such as cocaine and heroin. We also know that ostensibly, the Meeks were also friends with the Smart family. Although it's difficult to really pinpoint when all of these families became friends with one another, as most of the Sharp family is no longer alive. The Smarts have had shifting stories over the years, as have the Meeks family, concerning their various interactions, how they all met, etc., etc. But we can say with a fair level of accuracy that by 1980, all of these families knew one another, were interacting with each other, and that the Sharps and the Smart families were both living up in Keddy Resort, where, at least according to the Plumas County Sheriff's, a number of drug dealers as well as a drug house was located. Some stories paint the community up in Keddy and with, you know, rose-tinted glasses, you know, blue-collar, low-income, hard-working families all kind of living in this communal setting. Others paint it as little more than slums. I think probably the truth is somewhere in the middle. You did have hard-working families. You also had families that weren't so hard-working and were getting by any way that they could, while putting forth as little effort as possible. And I'm telling you this in order to try and paint a picture, really, of this area that we're talking about, where these horrific crimes are going to take place, and a lot of suspicion and speculation is going to start swirling around and continues to swirl around to this day. Now, this next area that we're going to talk about is going to be rather disturbing for some listeners. The majority of the information we're going to discuss at this part can, in fact, be verified, although certain parts of it cannot be verified. Now, the first piece of information we're going to discuss can be confirmed conclusively. On July 1st of 1980, Tina and one of her friends were in Quincy when a man offered to give them ice cream. Instead of giving them the offered treat, the man got them inside of his trailer where he sexually assaulted them. As best as I can reconstruct what happens after this, the girls go back to Tina's friend's house, where the friend tells her mother what happens. She contacts the Plumas County Sheriff's Department, who send over a male deputy who takes statements from the girls. The mother has a problem with this, as given the serious nature of the crime, she doesn't believe that a male deputy, whom she described as crass and rude, should be interviewing her daughter and Tina Sharp. So the Plumas County Sheriff's Department bring the girls into headquarters, where they are interviewed by a female clerk working inside of the office. Now, supposedly, the interview with this clerk is recorded. However, it doesn't take, and both girls refuse to be questioned further. We do know that in the Sheriff's Department's incomplete files concerning this case, that it was stated by the original investigating officer, quote, "It has been my observation that the victim is a very opinionated 8-year-old. I believe the best statements will be the ones obtained by Deputy Lelber and myself immediately following the incident." The man, Daniel Werman French, ends up being arrested and charged with sexual assault of minors. And from all appearances, it looks like this is a pretty straightforward case. They have witnesses who saw the man with the girls. They have both girls' original statements given immediately after the assault took place. But the case doesn't really move forward. We know that a week after the assault occurred, police went looking for both of the girls. They end up finding Sue Sharp at her cabin in Keddy, and she informs them that her daughter Tina is over at the other victim's house. However, when police go to this other address, there is nobody home. The accused ends up dismissing his lawyer at around this point in time, and beyond an indictment being filed, the case seemingly stops being investigated entirely. Now, the next part we're going to look at, while much of it is confirmable, not all of it can be. And this concerns the pregnancy that Sheila Sharp, the oldest daughter of Sue Sharp, has during 1980 and into 1981. Now, according to Sheila and members of the Meeks family, Sheila, who at this point is 13, 14 years old, ends up becoming pregnant by one of the Meek boys, with most people stating that it was Richard Meeks that was the father. Richard was 3 years older than Sheila. Some people believe that it may, in fact, have been John Sharp's friend, Dana Wingate, that was the father. In any event, we know that Sheila did become pregnant, that when Sheila has the baby in 1981, her mother sends Sheila up to Oregon to live with her sister, where the child is born and then placed up for adoption, after which Sheila returns to Keddy to live with her family. There are stories out there that cannot be confirmed that Sheila was extremely resentful towards her mother for making her give up this child. These same individuals have put forth that because of this, Sheila is going to end up becoming embroiled in a murder plot. I am going to say emphatically that I have found no evidence through everything that I've looked through to indicate that Sheila Sharp was in fact involved in the commission of these horrific murders. I say that because to me it's highly speculative and nearly implausible to imagine that a 13, 14-year-old girl who has just gone through the trauma of childbirth and being forced to give up said child is going to be involved in plotting and carrying out the commission of a quadruple homicide that involves not only her mother, whom, if Sheila was angry at her, it's reasonable to understand why, but also her older brother, as well as her younger sister, whom it's been said Sheila had a very close relationship with. Now, if all of this wasn't Twin Peaks-esque enough, things are just gonna get weirder from here. Numerous sources state that there's a very good possibility that Sue Sharp and Marty Smart were having an affair. Now, according to this thread of thought, the two of them would often meet at Keddie's back door, which was the bar attached to the lodge in Keddie Resort. It was kind of down the street or down the hill from the cabins and is where Marty worked. As to the veracity of this claim that Sue and Marty were having an affair behind Marilyn Smart's back, we can't state with absolute certainty that this was the case, only that numerous people have gone on the record as stating that this was in fact the case, and I'm relating this information simply in the interest of being thorough in our coverage of this case. Now, if we assume that this was in fact true, that Sue and Marty were in fact carrying on an affair behind Marty's wife's back, that would give reason for Marty to much later be named as a suspect in these murders. But as we're going to see while we go further into this, there is other evidence out there that suggests that drugs may in fact have been the reason for these crimes having been committed. Personally, I do believe, with the evidence that's available, including statements from Plumas County Sheriff's officers, that there was probably a relationship going on between Sue and Marty that went well beyond that of a casual friendship. Again, as I discussed earlier, from everything I have read concerning this case, it seems more likely than not that Sue Sharp was going through something of an identity crisis following the collapse of her marriage, something that is not uncommon for both men and women faced with this type of situation, wherein the life that they have built for themselves completely falls apart and they find themselves cast adrift in life, seeking a new avenue forward as well as, you know, trying to reclaim their identity. We can say with certainty that Sue Sharp had a number of different men that she was known to have seen following her arrival in Quincy, California, circa 1978-1979, and that according to Plumas County Sheriff's authorities, Martin Smart was considered a player, i.e. a man who was known throughout the community to have had numerous extramarital affairs behind his wife's back during the time that he was in Keddy. Now we're going to move on into the year of 1981. Most of the key players are living in and around Keddy by this point. In February of 1981, the owners of the cabins in Keddy Resort, ostensibly the owners of Keddy Resort, from what I could find, whose names are given as both the Albans and Hogabohms, began evicting residents from the cabins that they felt were troublemakers. According to statements made to police as well as other sources, some of those who were thrown out of the cabins were known drug dealers who were supplying drugs in both Keddy as well as in Quincy. Also, during this point in time, Marty ends up getting fired from his job at Keddy's back door, with the owner stating that he was fired because he was not a good cook. Some believe that Marty was actually fired because the owners discovered that he was selling drugs out of the bar / lodge, and they didn't want this type of element around their establishment. Now, the loss of this job meant a couple of things. First and foremost, that unless they could start paying rent, the Smart family was going to have to move. Although, I have unable to find a concrete timeline of when they were supposed to move by. Most evidence indicates that they were informed that they were going to have to leave somewhere around May of 1981. Which, if that's the case, the landlord is giving them a decent window of time in order to vacate the premises. Also in February of 1981, Sue Sharps sends her children to live with various friends in the area, including the Meeks family, as she heads up to Oregon, where Sheila is ready to give birth to this child. Some state that Sheila did not want to do this. Some further state also that the Meeks family did not want Sheila to give this child up, as Nina Meeks supposedly wanted her first grandchild to be a part of the family. Whatever the case, we know that the child ends up being put up for adoption. There's some speculation that during this point in time, in February-March of 1981, Marilyn Smart becomes aware of this supposed relationship between her husband and Sue Sharp. There is some evidence to support this, namely the fact that not long after Sue Sharp returns to Keddy with Sheila, Marilyn Smart kicks her husband Marty out of their cabin. This could be because Marty was sleeping around on her, also be due to the fact that it's apparent Marty cannot keep a job, and the family's station wagon, which Marilyn's aunt over in Burnie had co-signed for, breaks down, and the family simply stops making payments on it. In any event, Martin Smart ends up in Reno, Nevada, at a VA hospital, as Martin is a Vietnam War veteran. He claims that he is shell-shocked, which we now call PTSD. Records indicate that while there, Marty Smart was trying to get put on disability for his time in the government because of this PTSD. And it's said that while he's in Reno, Marty meets a man with alleged ties to organized crime in Chicago. This is Severin John Beau Babade, who is born July 26, 1931 in Chicago. Okay. Some sources state that Beau, as he was known to friends and acquaintances, was a military veteran, others that he was not. The VA claims that they have no records indicating that Beau Babade was in fact ever tied to any branch of the armed forces. What we do know is that he had a rather lengthy rap sheet. However, FOIA requests have really turned up nothing concerning this, beyond the fact that he was arrested and incarcerated for robbery on a few occasions. Now, the FBI stated that Beau had connections to organized crime. If he did, I highly doubt that he was very high up in the outfit's eyes. From all indications, Beau was more likely than not a low-level associate who knew some wise guys. He may have fenced items for them, they may have fenced items for him. He may too have sold drugs for them, and that may in fact been why he was out in Reno at the time that he encounters Marty. The idea that he was a mob enforcer, however, to me is laughable at best. All evidence indicates that Beau was simply a hustler, a scam artist, and con man who would spin tall tales about who he was and where he had been, the things he had done, while perpetrating his next scam. I personally believe that he knew Marty long before they ever met up in Reno, and may in fact have been one of the individuals getting Marty drugs to sell in and around Keddie and Quincy. It's also possible that he may have met up with Marty in Reno because Marty owed him money for these drugs, and that he returned to Keddie with Marty after their brief stay in Reno in order to collect this money. Something that I'm going to get into in the next episode more in detail. In any event, the two of them meet up in Reno, and from all accounts, are inseparable from this point forward. Now, at some point after having gone to Reno, both Marty and Beau return to Keddie, where Beau starts setting up scams, going to the police to run ads in a non-existent police magazine that he alleged he was a part of, as well as informing them that he was a cop many years earlier back in Chicago in order to gain their trust. There's also evidence that he may have scammed others in the area out of money in a similar fashion. In any event, he ends up moving in with the Smart family when he and Marty get back to Keddie. And again, the two men are completely inseparable. There's also been speculation that Beau was having a relationship with Sue Sharp. That, as with so many things in all of the different narratives, cannot be definitively proved. I personally doubt that is the case, just from the available information. But as you can see, there are a lot of moving parts in this story. Not only concerning Bo and his supposed organized crime connections and possible, although really unprovable, military service, but also, you know, the Smart family in general. Were Marty and Sue having an affair? Was Marilyn aware of it? Was anyone else aware of it? Was Sue having affairs with other married men in and around the area? But also, information that we haven't talked about yet, which is the idea that Sue's oldest son may have been involved in using drugs. There are stories that have circulated online that he was using drugs, that Marty may have been supplying them to him as well as to Dana Wingate. There are also stories out there that Dana Wingate's father may have been the one supplying the drugs to both boys as well as to Marty Smart. And we're going to look at the two boys, Dana Wingate and Johnny Sharp, for a few minutes, because the information that's out there does paint a less than stellar picture of both boys. That's not to say that either of them deserve to have been murdered. We know that Johnny was resentful over, you know, his life situation, mom leaving dad. We also know from statements that other family members gave, including Sue's brother, that Johnny was rather rambunctious, a troublemaker who liked smoking pot and drinking. Numerous peers told law enforcement after the murders had taken place that, to the best of their knowledge, Johnny didn't do any hard drugs, although at least one person told law enforcement that they believed Johnny and one of his friends were selling black beauties at school. We know from notes in law enforcement files that a man accused Johnny and a friend of his of stealing a lid of marijuana from him at some point around June of 1980. There are also stories of Johnny having gotten into numerous fights while in school. As for Dana Wingate, he was also known to smoke pot, drink. Many people who knew him said that he was confrontational. Some reports I have seen state that Dana was actually in foster care during 1979 and parts of 1980. We also know that during 1980, Dana ends up getting put on probation after slashing $7,000 worth of tires at a local car dealership. Other stories have floated around that Dana and or Johnny dabbled with cocaine. One story I came across in a forum stated that one or both boys may in fact have stolen cocaine from someone prior to these murders. However, the law enforcement files that are available make no mention of this. They only make mention of the supposed marijuana and acid thefts. And it is quite possible that this took place either for the boys' own usage or to sell at school, as Kenny and Quincy, as previously discussed, did have a fairly active drug culture. You know, and from all appearances, it seems that what we have here is two young boys who are having a hell of a go at life. They're frustrated, angry at the things that have occurred in their lives, and they're looking for a release of some type. Is very typical of boys in that age group, given the circumstances that both of them are faced with. You know, they're going to turn to using drugs, be it hard or soft, as well as alcohol, as a means to escape. But all of this is going to end up fueling rumors later on that these crimes were a drug hit, and that one or both of the boys were the intended targets of this murder for something they had done to someone, be it having stolen drugs for someone's house, or owing someone money, or ripping someone off during a drug deal. And you get that type of thing when a murder like this happens in every town. I don't care how big or small it is, and you just have to look at the case of the West Memphis 3 to see just, you know, how much speculation goes on and how much of that speculation can filter back to law enforcement and taint the witness and information pool. In the case of the two boys, the rumors were circulating pretty quickly that Dana Wingate's father, who Dana is supposedly supposed to have told people could get him all the drugs that he wanted, may have put a hit out on the boys. And again, that's supposedly speculation. There is no information available anywhere to back up this idea that his father was involved with drugs or had placed a hit on the two boys. And with the emergence of two suspects in the 2000s being named, that speculation moved to, you know, well, possibly the elder Wingate had hired one or both men to go and settle this score for him, or that Johnny or Dana had ripped off Marty at some point, or possibly that it was Sue who had done this, and therefore Marty and Bo go to the house to enact revenge or get their money back. As it's known that Marty was selling drugs, pot, hash, numerous people say cocaine, around Quincy and Ketty. And it's very possible that some of this information was already floating around in the community prior to April 11th, when the murders actually occur. You know that Marty is supposed to have said at some point prior to the murders, the months leading up to it, that if he ever sees Dana Wingate again, he's going to break the boy's hands. We also know that he thought Johnny Sharp was a troublemaking piece of shit. However, it should be noted that people who knew Marty said that he held a similar view of most, if not all, teenage boys. So now we have a lot of intrigue swirling around in the air through 1980 into 1981, which is going to lead us up to the night of April 11th, early morning hours of April 12th. Which we're going to be talking about in full in the next episode. I am going to end the episode at this point. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this first relook at the Ketty murders. And until next time, stay morbid.